Talvez. Não. Ah, não.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special bonus episode of the Nextlander Watchcast. That's right, two Watchcasts, 1 week. What a concept. That said, if you are listening to this one and you have not yet listened to our episode on Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, you have fucked up. You should stop this recording right now and go listen to that episode first.
Harsh.
Because yeah. I'm just saying, there is an order to this. I'm being very judgy, yes. This is a bonus episode that is specifically tackling the missing pieces, the collection of deleted scenes that came much after the fact from Fire Walk With Me. This is not going to be a full Watchcast episode. This will be a shorter discussion and mostly us just kind of talking about whether we think any of this stuff would actually belong in what I'm going to call our ideal 3-hour version of the movie, had they been allowed to actually make that version of the movie. But so when I described this stuff to you, did you guys have any real understanding or thoughts about what I was talking about? Did you think it was literally just a deleted scenes collection?
I expected it to be assembled into a little bit more of a narrative flow and structure than it is.
Mm-hmm.
It quite reads to me as DVD special features collection of deleted scenes.
Yeah.
To a large degree.
Like, it is not its own narrative, no.
Right. Right down to the editing, right down to like the kind of like fades down to black between scenes. Like, it seems like maybe they had an ADR'd some of these scenes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You get a lot of roomy reverb sound to a lot of the dialogue. It's rougher than I expected. I'll say that.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, it is, yeah, you're right. It is not a complete narrative. It is not a full film. It is a supplemental material, but it is more of an edit than it would be if it was literally just a bunch of disconnected, deleted scenes, which is what most Blu-rays and films end up having on their home video releases. This is something that David Lynch did edit together into, if not a narrative, then at least an order and a structure that he wanted.
I don't think I was expecting it to be feature length. I think I was,
yeah.
I was a little like, hold. And then as I was watching it, I agree with everything Brad said. There's a lot of like shots that sit in a wide shot for a long time that feel very like a black box theater-ish, like mm-hmm. a little like, is this the kind of local play production of Fire Walk With
right.
Me? And it, you know, the audio has a part to do with that. Like I said, I think Brad, you mentioned, it doesn't sound like they're going back in and doing ADR or looping. It's
no.
a lot of the natural audio. It made me mad at some points to be like, look, did you cut for time or did you cut to make this more confusing at points where you mm-hmm. lose some context from some scenes? But I also don't think this was as revelatory as I would expected going into it. It wasn't like suddenly the key was inserted into
right.
the lock and there's like people just doing exposition.
Yeah, no, it's not that. And the thing, the reason I wanted to do this and the reason I wanted to even like consider this as part of like our discussion on the larger series is that there are things that are in the missing pieces that do eventually get referenced in the return. Mm. So whether or not this every scene in this is exactly 100% Twin Peaks solidified canon, nonetheless, they are taking elements from things that did not appear in the final movie, and they are going back and referencing them later. And I think that's why it's worth seeing this stuff going into the return.
I mean, it feels like necessary viewing if you're trying to absorb this.
Yeah, if you want the complete picture of Twin Peaks and as complete as it gets, I think this is worth seeing.
Yeah.
To briefly touch here on why this exists at all. So when this movie came out, Fire Walk With Me specifically, obviously we were still in the VHS era. They had not gotten to the DVD special features period as of yet. And so when this movie eventually did come out on DVD, a lot of people, since a lot of movies were including deleted scenes and other special features, a lot of people were thinking, okay, well, this will be where we get to see whatever parts they cut out of that movie, and we'll get to see, you know, some of the stuff we've heard about from this that did not make it in the final film. The only reason anyone knows this footage exists, outside of, like, the people who made the movie, is because Twin Peaks was extremely popular in Japan. And it was a series that did very well there. The movie actually opened in Japan before it opened in the U.S., apparently. And there was some magazine or some other thing, I forget exactly what it was, but there was some magazine that showed stills from the movie that included two scenes that are only in the missing pieces, the Chet Desmond sheriff fight. And right. I think another scene of the Palmer dining room that is only in the missing pieces. And so people were like, oh, this shit is real. They filmed it. Like, those scenes are out there. And when the first DVD came around, none of that stuff was on it. They did not do any extras as far as, like, deleted scenes go. And there was an ongoing letter-writing campaign and a bunch of other stuff by the various Twin Peaks fandoms to try and get this stuff secured for some home video release along the way. And David Lynch did not want to just throw these out as a bunch of disconnected scenes. He wanted to do some work on them and do them as a more fleshed out feature than just a here's a bunch of supplemental material. And so they couldn't get the negotiations going. The rights weren't being secured. Things weren't happening. And then finally, this thing, the missing pieces, was constructed for one of the box sets. I think it was considered the complete mystery is what they called it, but it was also not the one that had everything in it, despite them calling it the complete mystery. It did have Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, and it did have this missing pieces feature.
So is that the one with that god-awful box art that's like half her face in life and half in death?
I think that's... The thing is, they may have used versions of that box art in some of the different box sets over the time, but I think that one had it, yeah.
Just a really creepy shot of... Laura Palmer, half alive and half dead.
Yeah. So they finally did it. They did the work. They got the rights secured, and they got David Lynch in an editing room. And so the reason a lot of these scenes don't have very many cuts in them is because they have not done the editing work to go in and do the close-ups. There are not those easy, like the thing you see in a scene where like they cut back and forth, close-ups, long shots,
just
all that kind of stuff.
And, yeah,
yeah all the inserts, all that. None of that is... If that footage is there, they did not have time to completely edit the scenes in complete fashion. So instead, what they're doing is they're just taking the takes that they think are the best and then putting them out there.
In some scenes are like felt like fully. I think that fight scene has a lot of, you know,
yes.
Fight cutting and the two scenes you mentioned, actually, the dinner scene also, I think, cuts around a lot to close-ups of the family.
This early, is this an alternate meeting with the diner owner? Or is that even the
it's
owner?
It's a longer one. Yeah, I think those sequences are scenes that were going to be in the completed film one way or the other. They just got trimmed down significantly.
Right, yes, right. Where you could see where maybe the editing work was done, and then they're like, cut it, and you can keep... You go back to an earlier saved project, and you can pull those scenes back out.
Yeah. And so, you know, when this stuff came out, it was pretty revelatory, because the people who most desperately wanted to see this had not seen any Twin Peaks since Fire Walk With Me. There had been none. So the idea of getting these scenes, which included a bunch of check-ins with characters that do not appear in the film at all, but are mainstays of the show, was revelatory for, you know, the super fans of this show.
It's so bananas.
Yeah. But I also understand, it felt like it would feel like a completely different movie if this stuff was in there.
It would be too long.
It would be too long and not focused.
Even with your hypothetical 3-hour cut that you've offered, I mean, it's good you said that, because prior to that, if you had said, should any of this been in the movie, I would have just issued a blanket no, because the movie is already 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I was just like, yeah, there's no room for any of this in there. I mean...
Well, I think there are a few scenes in here that I would actually like to see in a longer cut of this movie, because I think not only do they add a certain context, but I think there is a flavoring that still fits within the larger scope of the movie. A lot of that stuff isn't the stuff featuring your favorite Twin Peaks personalities, because that stuff is nice. It's fan service, though, and the idea of fan service in a David Lynch movie is maybe the most alien concept I can think of.
Yeah, though some of the scenes in here are like... If they're not fan service, I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Because some of them are just like, this does nothing for the plot of the movie.
Like, why are you here other than we cast you and we're paying you a day rate? So why are we doing this?
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was very happy to see Pete again. But but did that scene belong in that movie? Absolutely not.
No, not remotely. So we'll just kind of go through the scenes here and we'll talk about whether you think they have any real importance or whether they are totally superfluous. And that is kind of going to be our discussion here. But sure. So. The early stuff here is mostly with Desmond and Sam. There's a longer sequence involving them out behind the police station getting ready to go to the diner. There's a much longer scene of them walking into the diner. There's the much longer sequence of them talking to the guy in the back room. And then there's the stuff outside at dawn when they're getting ready to go out to the trailer park and the stuff with the waitress.
had the FBI here once before, back in the 50s when Hap was running the place.
Where's Hap?
He's dead, good and dead.
Sorry to hear that.
He didn't suffer.
I'd like to ask you some questions about Teresa Banks.
Sheriff Cable already asked me a few questions about Teresa Banks. She worked nights for a month, and that's it.
Any friends?
No.
Did you ever see her with someone else?
No.
Did she ever mention any friends?
No. Ask Irene about that. Now, Irene is her name, and it is Knight. Don't take it any further than that. There's nothing good about it.
I don't think any of this is important.
No, I thought that stuff... I started to say I thought it moved just fine in the final cut. I don't know if I quite mean that, because there's some parts of that stuff that are still quite languid.
Yes.
Like the guy repeating himself at the counter three times and stuff like that. But still, I think it achieves the effect he was going for, whether it is economical or not. He at least probably hit what he was looking for there. This just feels like it would dilute that.
I think you could have kept a little bit more of the back room conversation with the weird old guy in the light, but other than that, I don't think any of this stuff matters that much.
That's what I was going to say. Just the setup for them, because I think he says it's late, don't talk to her, whatever, and that's when they just walk in. Having a little more setup just helps flesh out what the hell they're doing there.
I do really enjoy the greater focus on the name tag on the old guy, though, because it says, say hello to Jack, but then hello is crossed out and says goodbye written in pen.
Yeah, that's in the final cut too, right?
It is. You just don't really see very much of it because they don't linger on him very long.
Yeah, I thought I remembered seeing that. Does he have some dialogue that they also gave to Irene? That she worked here. She worked here for a month. Stuff also you get from Irene in the final cut. Anyway,
I mean, it seems like the reason it's like that is very much no one here gave a shit about her and really thought about her more than the fact that she didn't show up on time ever.
Right.
Now, that said, the next scene, I think, is something that actually could have been in the movie, probably in a shorter version than what we see in the missing pieces. But this is the fight between Desmond and Sheriff Cable, where they fight over the custodianship of Teresa Banks' body for what I'm going to say is not going to hold up in court.
Like, this was definitely the most entertaining thing in this entire thing to watch.
Yeah.
It's also very long.
Should it have been in the final movie? Probably not.
I think a truncated version could have been.
But definitely my favorite thing in this.
I think the problem I have is that I don't like that there's no resolution with Sheriff Cable being such a dickhead. Because he is. He's an astronomical dickhead.
Yes, that's part of why I like the scene is watching him get his comeuppance.
Yeah. And again, more Chris Isaac is not necessarily what I'm looking for in this movie, but I think this scene is fun, and a, let's say, half as long as it is version of it would have worked in the movie without disrupting the pacing too much.
I definitely appreciate Chris Isaac's, like, very 50s style putting up his dukes when he's ready to fight here.
Oh, yeah.
Like, felt very consistent with the square-jawed government man persona.
This one's coming from J. Edgar.
Could have gotten Chris Isaac to do the Rocketeer.
You guys like Chris Isaac? Like as a musician?
As a musician?
I couldn't name a single song other than Wicked Game.
I think that album with Wicked Game on it is great. I don't know if I've ever actually heard any of his other stuff.
Huh. Interesting.
I had a guy I was in a punk band with. This dude who was like in his mid-40s, like an old gutter punk. That dude loved Chris Isaac for some reason. I was like his favorite singer.
Okay.
And I'm like, sure, why not?
There's no shame in it.
No. This next scene is definitely not something that needs to be in the movie, but I love that it's here at all, is Cooper talking to Diane.
Diane, you haven't changed your hair, and I've seen that beautiful dress before, but I must say, you look sensational today. No, I'm not trying to buy time. It's Thursday, and you have changed something in this room. And this time you've done very well, very well. But I'm going to tell you exactly what it is in a moment. You have changed. Got it. Diane, you've moved that clock 12 inches to the left. Ah, yes, another triumph for the dashing Agent Cooper. And now, Diane, you Must clean the coffee cups, get fresh ground coffee from Sally, and make a damn great pot of coffee.
This one broke my brain a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm still on the fence of whether Diane is real and Diane exists in the real world. And here he is, like, supposedly making eye contact and
Diane speaking to someone in a room that we can't see.
Yeah.
He also kind of feels like he's talking to the door jamb at times. So.
Yeah.
But he asked Diane to also make some coffee, too. I don't know. I still don't know if Diane is real.
Granted, is Diane real or is Diane a delusion? Tell me right now.
I don't know. I can't. Diane. It could go either way. Diane is Cooper's coping mechanism.
All right.
Brad. Could be real in this universe.
I will be shocked if Diane turns out to be a real human being.
Okay.
But I would be shocked if they ever address it, actually.
Also kind of that.
Yeah.
Again, not a necessary scene, but kind of a fun, weird aside. I do think the next scene, though, which is Cooper and Sam kind of going more into the nitty-gritty of what they were doing before Desmond disappeared, is actually kind of an interesting little bit, not just because it's the only time that these two characters interact, but I think there's some good flavor in here, and I actually would be okay if this had ended up in the final film.
Gordon, show you a woman named Lil.
Stanley, I'm up to speed.
Agent Desmond never did explain to me what the Blue Rose meant.
Neither will I.
Yeah. You know, now that you mention it, yes, I'm not going to sit here and scrub through every scene to refresh my memory, but this might be the most appropriate.
Yeah.
Like this and maybe the Argentina stuff might be the stuff I could most see in the final movie of this entire thing.
Absolutely.
It also feels like a nice transition from Isaac's character to handing the case over to Cooper, basically.
Yes.
Like you get like a physical, this connective tissue, we're now moving the case over to Cooper.
Yeah.
I also enjoy this this image of Stanley as kind of like the Q of this whole thing. He's like the gadget guy.
Yeah, he's the scientist.
Right. Like you see the bow tie in the final cut of the movie, but you get a better look at the bow tie and suspenders. Like he's so not regulation compared to everybody else in the, like, he seems to be the only guy in the bureau who doesn't put half a can of pomade in his hair.
No.
You know?
And he dresses like fucking Renfield in Dracula.
Right. Right. That's what I mean. Like he is so out of step with like the fashion and presentation of everybody else here. I just kind of like that.
Try not to make a reaction, Alex, but I'm really looking forward to seeing Kiefer in The Return. I want this character back.
So on that note,
uh-huh.
Now it's time to talk about David Bowie in extended form. We get the little bit in the hotel initially where he goes to the front desk and he asks if a Miss Judy is staying there and gets no real response in return. And then it just cuts straight to the Philadelphia office after a quick shot of someone's mouth.
Of course.
And then this long bit here, before we really get into the David Bowie stuff, the long version of the room above the convenience store.
Oh my gosh, yes, this is so long, and also disturbing, and screamy, and I don't know.
But you get a much more extended look here at what this room looks like and what these the features of these creatures are.
Creature features.
And it's interesting. Like, you know, the room itself is kind of tattered in the way that a lot of, like, David Lynch arty stuff tends to look. But the way the figures you don't know are portrayed is interesting. Like, the guys with the giant woolly beards, those beards are so fake, it has to be on purpose. You don't walk in there and say, like, oh, yeah, that looks good. Like, that's intentional. And there's a lot of dialogue here from the man from another place, slash the arm. He talks about the ring. With this ring, I thee wed. The grandson is back there talking on the couch. There's a little bit of Red Room stuff here, and the guy with the mask dancing around. And then, yes, we are in Philadelphia, and here is the much longer version of the David Bowie conversation with Cole and the gang.
Which is, again, I don't know. This is one of those things that maybe makes more sense once you've absorbed everything, but I'm not sure this needed to be added more because it's just confusing.
It is, but I do think having more of the Bowie stuff is actually worthwhile because...
I will always take more Bowie.
Yeah.
So that's
and it's
unfair.
Not just it's not just to hear him say, "Hell, God, baby, damn, no." Like, that's not the only reason, though that is yeah. pretty good.
It was a dream. We lived inside a dream.
And it's raining post-toasties.
Hell, God, baby, damn, no. I found something in Seattle at Judas. And then... there they were. And they sat quietly for hours. And I followed. Oh.
Ring. The ring.
Albert? I'll take that second mineral water.
I just think that some of the other stuff you get in here with him more specifically pointing at Cooper and be like, who do you think that is? And mm-hmm. the stuff with Albert like really grilling him. I think some
talk
of
about
that,
Judy.
Yeah, I think some of that stuff is actually pretty worthwhile.
Sure.
And I also like the bit like before the disappearance where like the electronics start going wonky and Cole is like trying to talk in the speaker, like, give me some good news.
What is he? I forget what he says, but he's like, the gadget doesn't work. Or the thing doesn't work.
Cooper, the device has gone faulty.
Right, the device has gone faulty.
Mayday. He says mayday over and over.
Yeah. Which causes Bowie to look up and start saying February 1989, which, you know, we don't really know what the hell, why he would know anything about 1989 or what might happen, because this is before that. Technically, there's a little bit of timeline fudging stuff you kind of have to do with some of this stuff, but just roll with it is what I say. Don't worry too much about the extreme particulars of the narrative.
But I do love his like time cop like style Terminator return.
Yes,
when he comes back,
is why I think this scene belongs in the movie.
The line from this dude.
Uh huh.
I can't. I'm too embarrassed to say it.
What? Oh, Mr. Jeffries! Oh, the shit that come out of my ass. Santa Maria, where did you go? I know the man! I know the man!
Apparently, I was reading an interview with a couple people that worked on the movie. They were all very mad that scene did not make it into the final film because they were like, this is the thing. Everyone was saying that to each other on set after that scene was filmed. Like, that was their internal joke.
You probably could have just slipped this in somewhere. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You could have made it a little dream sequence in the middle of the Philadelphia scene where Bowie's trying to explain himself or whatever. You could have, like, flashed back to that pretty easily.
Yeah. But it also what this seems to imply is that wherever Jeffries is or was, he is not all the way back. Something is happening with him where he is not able to control his physical form in a way he maybe was before he disappeared 2 years ago.
Maybe he found another portal somewhere.
Could be. We don't know.
Yeah.
But he did say he's seen one of their meetings and has been to the room above the convenience store. So do with that what you will. But I do think some version of this scene I would have liked to have seen in the film in more elaborate fashion than it ended up being. The next bits here, not anything really super important. There's a longer catcalling scene that kind of takes place with Bobby and Mike as Laura and Donna are going to school. I maybe would have liked to have had this stuff in there just because the way that Bobby and Mike start calling at them from off screen is a little awkward in the final film. But I don't think you have to have any of this. It's not important.
Wait, is Mike in the final film?
His voice is. I don't think he actually appears.
Okay, because I was going to say Mike leading the list of people from the show in this thing who didn't make the final cut.
Yeah.
But maybe not, kind of.
Not that Mike was ever super important in the series, but he was more of a tag along. But yeah, like he doesn't really have anything else to do.
This has also made me realize how strange it is that there are two Mikes in the show.
Two Bobs, technically, too.
Two Bobbies.
Yeah, sure.
One's an angel and one's a demon.
Mm-hmm. You get this little interstitial bit with Sarah and Laura, where Sarah's coming home with the groceries and the cigarette. It's more of a weird goof moment. I don't think you have to have this in the movie. The only reason I would say maybe is just I wish there was a little bit more of the Sarah and Laura dynamic in the final film.
Yeah, she doesn't get a lot to do except like be drugged and be very passive
and frantic. Yeah,
in this, and I thought this is good because like this shows that she's also there as a parent trying to deal with all of this stuff in weird ways. And it's not necessarily this scene, but I don't know if you can have this scene without the one later where she's asking where her sweater is.
Exactly.
And it also further characterizes her because it shows her very strongly not wanting Laura to become a smoker.
Yeah.
Which you realize like her smoking is very much just a coping mechanism for having to live with Leland.
And maybe because, with the understanding that something is very, very wrong.
Right. Like in the final cut, like it's like light is made of the fact that she smokes so much. But then you realize here she probably actually hates that she smokes. And it's probably how she deals with all this shit.
I also think you can draw a little bit of the mysticism around Sarah into that as well. Because we know that Sarah has visions in much the way that Laura was having visions. And I think the I don't want you to smoke is more of a larger statement of I don't want you to end up like me. Metaphorically speaking. I do like the dinner scene that comes after it, though, where Leland is coming in and discussing the Norwegians and acting more like the Leland we kind of knew from the show before we knew what he actually was.
Sure.
Okay. All together now. Oh. Hold hands. A little bow, a little formal bow. Higley o mota dem, ja heter Leland Harmer. Higle omote dem, 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 higle omote dem.
And I like the bit where he's trying to teach them Norwegian and they're having like a little family get together moment. It probably doesn't fit the tone of the final film
right.
at all.
Yes.
But I think having something in there that shows there was a family dynamic here that wasn't nonstop torture in moments, I think also makes those moments of horror actually hit harder.
Yeah, in the actual cut, there's really no redeeming moments for Leland at
None.
All. He's either confused or being a monster.
At and most, there like, occasional moments of apologetic, yeah. But that's it.
But mostly because he did something horrible.
Yeah.
The only thing that's weird with this one, and I do like the scene, is the laugh at the end feels like it's so long.
Yeah.
It's like uncomfortably long.
You're getting the full take.
Yeah. Like somebody didn't yell cut. They just let them laugh and laugh at the end of it.
That's what filmmaking
forever.
Is, man. You just let the actors go until you know you need them to stop. And if they're still going, just capture it and then cut it out.
Yeah. But they didn't cut it out. They just
they cut all of it out in the movie, to
I
be
guess
fair.
That's true. That's true.
You get this one scene of Laura going and hooking up with this random trucker who she supposedly met with through Leo. I don't think this is necessary. It doesn't really add anything that you don't get in the final film from other, encounters that she has.
Yeah, like this is sleazy and tragic, but so is the whole thing with the two guys in the across the border.
And it's so much less meaningful than I think any of the other scenes they kept, so not necessary. What is necessary, though, definitely, is a whole fucking scene of Del Mibler.
Look, I enjoyed this because it's a common knowledge in the woodworking world that a 2x4 is not 2x4.
Uh-huh.
So this joke was just
You get it.
For
it's
me.
For you.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. It's really for me.
Oh, okay.
But it is long.
I had completely forgotten this is the bank dude, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't put that together until you just said his name just now, because when I was watching this, I was just like, who the fuck is this guy?
Is a dollar worth a dollar still at your bank?
I wanted 2x4.
Mr. Mibler, look. Down at your bank, is a dollar still worth what it used to be?
I see what you mean.
Understand.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You can tell that somewhere along the way, David Lynch just fell in love with this actor that plays Del Mibler in this one scene, at the end of Twin Peaks, the series run, and he's like, we got to get him in the movie somehow.
Yep.
But the scene is not at all important.
I mean, if you were going for, you know, Pete really runs the mill and Josie doesn't really know what to do, but like that's irrelevant to this whole other story.
Yeah. None of that comes into play in any meaningful way.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to see them again, but completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
No Catherine in this.
No.
In addition to Ben Horn, no Catherine.
Yeah. Yeah, like no Ben stands out because no Audrey.
Yeah.
But now that you mention it, yeah, it didn't even occur to me. No Piper Laurie in this.
Mm-hmm.
The entirety of the Ghostwood thing, all their machinations and everything, like pretty irrelevant to Laura Palmer.
Yeah.
When you get down to it, like it's like a different adjacent or parallel soap opera plot in the show, right?
Totally.
But really has not much to do with the murder.
I mean, if Twin Peaks the series was about the townspeople, then this movie is absolutely dedicated to doing the opposite of that. It does not focus on the townspeople at all. It is about one person primarily.
Mm-hmm.
We now get a much longer version of the diner sequence, which does appear in the movie. There's a lot more with Norma and Shelley in the lead up to Laura freaking out and taking off from the parking lot. There is a brief appearance of both Ed and Nadine making her only appearance in the movie. And I really was happy to see Ed. I really like the scene that happens with Ed and Norma later. None of it belongs in the movie.
Again, if you had to do the setup work to be like, you know, Norma is on tough times, the diner's not doing well, but like, again, none of it's relevant to what we're doing here.
And in fact, that's a plot line they don't even really address in the show. The idea that the double R is like struggling, other than the fact that there just aren't a lot of people in there generally.
They have that like one brief part with the food critic and like, they're going to dress the tables up and that whole thing.
But it's never like the double R is going to close, you know? Like that's never a storyline they do.
No.
And there's a longer bit here with Donna and Laura in the Haywards home after she goes in there tearfully, you know, talking to Donna, and there's a long sequence here with Doc Hayward and his wife, including Doc Hayward doing some close-up magic, not very well, but in a funny way. And there's a line in there with him talking about the angels and stuff. And here's the thing. I actually think this should be in the movie.
Yeah, I could see it. I actually like the exchange between them before he even comes in.
Mm-hmm.
About the, like, Donna's like, I'm thinking about doing it with Mike. You don't even like Mike. It's like, this isn't about like, it's about sex, you know?
Yeah. That's a great little moment there.
That is a good exchange that I think would have actually fit in the movie.
And it's like, I understand that you're basically at this point trimming away a lot of the superfluous characters, but I think the Haywards as a model of a normal family for Laura are actually worth putting in front of her and in front of the audience because they mean something to her beyond just sort of being figures that she knows from around town. And I think the stuff with Doc Hayward in the scene is actually really good.
This isn't a prescription. It's a secret message for Laura. The angels will return. And when you see the one that's meant to help you, you will weep with joy. Hello. Yeah, she's right here, Liam. Laura, it's for you. It's your father.
Yeah, actually, this would probably be one of the scenes that I would take back to a rewatching of the original series of Twin Peaks when Doc Hayward has to identify Laura and work on the body, because you could see here that there's an actual real relationship. He knows that Laura is troubled, but he's trying to understand it, give her space, you know, why do I let you smoke in my house kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, she's like, because you're awesome.
Because everybody loves Laura.
Yeah, right. And so like when I think it's Miguel Ferreira's character is going to take the body and Doc Hayward gets kind of upset, right?
Yeah.
That
all kind of feeds into all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. That feels like there's more fleshed out here. Also, this whole muffin thing.
Yeah.
You're the muffin.
I am
the muffin, Donna. You're the muffin.
No, Donna. You're right. I'm the muffin.
Look, is that important? No, but it does give you some context, at least.
Yeah.
I was just kind of like Doc Hayward.
Yes. He's one of the only normal people in this entire town.
And I would say his wife was there until they rolled her up into whatever plot was going on at the end of season two.
Yeah. The less said about that, the better.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, seeing her appear here was actually just a bad reminder of that shitty dangling plot thread.
Bad cold glass of water in your face.
Yeah.
The next sequence is a longer, different angle on the stuff that we do see in the movie from the Red Room, where Cooper is talking to the man from another place, the arm and the ring and all that stuff in the Formica table. Or not the Formica table, but the sort of marble table that they keep the ring on. It's not really that different, but there is stuff at the end that sort of feeds into this scene that does kind of become important. That said, I think the amount of this stuff they put in the final film is probably enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you need any more of this.
I don't think I understand the relevance of it at this point, except for maybe the parts where Dale is like, I don't know where I am. I don't know what's going on.
That is saying, at the end, I think that stuff actually does have some relevance, but not in the way that this movie is trying to tell this story.
Right.
You then get the longer bit here where Laura is talking to Bob in the ceiling fan. And I actually kind of wish this was in this form in the movie. Because
oh my gosh.
It's so much more terrifying.
This shot of the, like, I don't know, stop frame smile thing.
Yeah.
It's very.
You get flashes of it in the final film, but the way it's portrayed here is really something.
It's got some real Joker gas.
Yeah. And again, I think the little bit where, you know, Sarah comes in at the end and she's like, where's my sweater? And she's wearing it.
Yeah.
Like, I think some of that flavor with her and Sarah is actually kind of interesting, and I wish it could have been fleshed out more in the final film.
Totally. Yes. I actually really like the scene because Sarah is clearly also going through some kind of journey.
Yeah.
That is kind of hand-waved away a little bit.
Yeah. The longer scene with Leo teaching Shelley how to clean the floor because he's on benzos is not important, but I do think just having that little extra bit at the beginning explaining that he is whacked out of his gourd while he's doing this at least lets you understand why he's so fucking edgy about cleaning the floor. But you don't have to have any of this. Now, like, there's nothing communicated here that you don't get in the final movie.
Yeah, and Leo's an asshole.
And Leo's still a fucking asshole. This is the Ed and Norma scene in the truck. They've been getting drunk and listening to music out in the truck, out in the woods. And I love this scene, and it hurts my heart to say it's not important and doesn't need to be there, but I think this scene is great.
Yeah.
Playing with a handheld breathalyzer.
Mm-hmm.
Of every scene in this entire thing, I feel like this is the one that is most to me, like, why did they even shoot this? Like, this is so far afield of anything going on with Laura Palmer. Like, I'm kind of shocked they even, like, staged this.
I honestly think a lot of this stuff was just Lynch trying to find ways to get these characters into the mix in some way or another, and I think he just likes these characters and wanted to do something with them. I think that's all it is.
Yeah, like, if you're making... I'm with you, Brad. This feels, like, completely out of place for this movie, but if you're making a prequel to the events of Twin Peaks, then okay. Or, sure, you shoot a thing where, like, they're together and, you know, will they, won't they beforehand, right? Like, I don't know. But yes, but it seems like such small potatoes to the stakes that are in this movie.
It is. It doesn't belong here. I wish it did, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
Another thing that definitely doesn't belong here, though it has, you know, I think some good flavor moments here and there, is the journey up to the pink room across the Canadian border. You don't need this scene. You don't need to see them go from point A to point B, but... Unless you don't have the subtitles, apparently.
Unless you know what I was going to say.
That maybe actually would have helped there.
Yeah, like, oh, okay, they're leaving and they're going somewhere. Okay.
Yeah.
I guess you're right. It's not necessary. I mean, there is some character stuff out here with Donna refusing the cocaine and stuff.
Yeah, her refusing the cocaine, the guy driving recklessly. Like, there's some stuff in there that adds some flavor to what ends up happening in the pink room, but I don't think it's anything that changes what you understand about that scene.
Yeah. Also, what is the power and the glory? Is that just like a code phrase for drugs?
So this is the thing that is a little confusing because depending on where you see it and whether you take this to be canon or not, the power and the glory appears on the door to the room that is essentially the pink room.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the pink room on the soundtrack, The pink room is either the band, the room, or something, or the song. The Power and the Glory is either the band, the room, or something else.
Okay.
There's a lot
well,
of
she
weird...
says it, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She says
yeah,
it.
I feel
so
like
the trucker.
I feel like yeah. It yes. That I think that's where it is. Right, is that it appears almost like a code phrase elsewhere.
Yeah.
All you need to know is most people just refer to the room as the pink room. The Power and the Glory is just something floating around the background. I don't think you need to seize on it with okay. any seriousness. From here, we get this very quick shot of Mike channeling something in a hotel room.
I think this is cool. This is a cool visual.
It is.
It doesn't need to be in here, but I just it's yeah. it's a cool thing to do with the reverse footage.
Yeah, the reverse putting the candles out thing is cool. Like the reverse talking is cool, but they kind of lay it on a little thick.
Yeah.
In this, but this is something you haven't seen before. That's pretty neat.
It is, but again, the scene doesn't really lead to anything that you can't get in the movie without it.
No.
I do think some of the stuff that comes up next here with Teresa Banks, kind of the early goings of Leland reaching out to her through her ad in Flesh World, some of this stuff is interesting. I don't think you need the longer scene of him chickening out with Laura and Ronette. I don't think you need the bit of her going to the phone booth and calling Jacques, basically like looking to blackmail Leland. But if you put all this stuff in the movie, I don't think it would be any worse for it if it was there.
Yeah, I think you get a little bit of, like, not that Leland or Bob needs motivation, but you get a little bit more fleshing out of, like, what's going on here between
yeah.
these two, of, like, why she becomes such a target, you know, what the threat is,
it's,
what
it's
she
mostly
has
just
going
casually
on.
Mentioned in the movie. It is not really elaborated yeah. upon.
Yeah, and she seems much more competent and aware.
Yeah.
You know, like, she knows what she's got going on here.
And then you get some extended stuff here of, you know, more Palmer living room, Laura doing more key bumps. And then we get our first and one of only two check-ins with the Twin Peaks Sheriff's Department.
What did say was weird?
Yeah. I
yeah.
mean, what's weird about it? Articulate.
Is Harry just basically trying to let Andy figure this all out on his own?
Yes,
or like,
I think so.
Is that what's just going on here? Like, just patiently, like, it's because the trails, Andy? What's...
Joey just called in. Bernie the Mule left Canada about an hour ago.
Okay. That means we stop watching Jacques, set a trap for Bernie.
He's coming in on foot.
That's right, Andy. I guess you're saying there's an awful lot of trails for us to cover, hmm?
No, I was thinking what a long hike Bernie has to have.
So here's what you can take away from this scene, I think. The reason it exists at all is that this is the part where Sheriff Truman tells Hawk and Andy, stop following Jacques because I have this other thing I need you to go do. When they do this, this implies that because Sheriff Truman told them to do this, Laura Palmer dies.
Because
they would have been following
Jacques
otherwise, and they would have seen this happen.
Okay. I didn't put that together, but sure.
You don't have to have it, is the thing.
Yeah.
But it does imply that, like, Sheriff Truman is indirectly responsible for essentially the events that take place. Whatever the case, I don't think you have to have this scene. and if you don't have this scene, you definitely don't have the other sheriff scene, which we'll get to in a moment. There is a longer bit here in the high school... where after Bobby has killed that guy.
What's the sound? Burr. The sound she makes? Burr.
God.
I don't know. You don't need this scene, but it cracks me up a little bit.
No, you extremely don't need this scene. The only reason I think you maybe keep it is because the realization that finally crosses her face at the end when she's like, after he said, I killed a guy multiple times, it feels like she finally gets it.
Yeah. She has a great, like, charming smile to dead serious
death
look.
Stare. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like very, very well done.
I also don't think, I mean, again, if you're cutting a lot of this stuff, I don't think you need the scene of Bobby going out there and realizing the drugs were baby laxative.
No. It does undermine this whole death, though. But
yeah.
Yes.
On the one hand, I kind of appreciated that he did express some remorse for having killed somebody. On the other hand, it seems like it's only in the context of it's going to get him in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Like, and on top of that, they never address the fact that it's a deputy that he killed.
Right.
Nobody find they did a great job burying the body.
Apparently. I don't think this next scene is necessary either, though I probably would have thrown it into my 3-hour movie, which is the Dr. Jacoby calling Laura.
I told you not to call me here.
Well, you know, a little trouble with your parents is the least of your worries. And it's certainly something that I'm willing to put up with.
I'm not.
Did you make me a tape?
I already made you 2 tapes.
Laura, you're going to have to deal with all of this.
I'm dealing with it, Doc. Big time. Maybe I'll make you a tape tomorrow. Good night.
Laura? Send me a kiss.
I just have a technical question in movie making. Maybe you guys know. How do you do someone snorting cocaine in a movie?
I don't know. There's probably some kinds of inert powder that are fine to snort in small
really?
Quantities.
Like, you think that, oh my gosh. You like actually put something up your nose like that?
Oh yeah.
I think
oh
so.
I mean, yeah, okay. there are like actual drugs that are administered nasally, but
cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Yeah.
All right, I should look it up. I don't know. I can't be an actor.
No, anyway, I don't like putting things up my nose either, so it's why I never really did cocaine.
Back to Jacoby, which is, again, a scene which maybe just goes on to be like, Jacoby, you have a weird relationship with Laura.
Yeah, and we know that because we've watched the TV show. But,
yeah.
You know, again, this is not a necessary callback, but if I'm going to keep any of the totally unnecessary callbacks, this is maybe the one I keep.
It may be inositol.
Oh, boy. That's an inert thing to put up your nose?
This random article I found says that powdered milk and baking soda have been used in the past.
Okay.
Oh, gosh.
But these days it is that.
All right.
Which is often used to cut actual cocaine.
Jeez. Okay.
It's a vitamin B powder that gives you a slight energy lift.
Okay.
Okay.
I should start doing that.
Snorting vitamin B.
Yeah. Speaking of vitamin B, let's go to the Briggs house.
Uh-huh. Vitamin Briggs.
Yeah, man, fuck. I was very excited to see him appear, and then he barely does anything.
Yeah, I mean, look, like every other character, he's not really part of this story. That said, if you were to tell me what is a random, weeknight at the Briggs's look like, this isn't far off from what I would imagine.
Is that the Bible he's reading from?
Yes. I believe he's reading from Revelations, if I remember correctly.
This feels like it could have been in there because the shorter version of this is in the movie, right?
Where they meet
it is. In the basement.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably shouldn't be because at that point you are barreling toward the murder and you know it, right? Like you realize you're in the, you know, like events are accelerating basically. So that it probably would have slowed things down.
And in the shorter version, she is much more manic. I feel like you just get a real hyped up, Laura Palmer.
Yeah. And the thing I will say is I think you probably have to cut the Briggs, the parents' Briggs stuff, but I actually wish the longer version of the scene with Bobby was in the movie because I think it gives a great context to what eventually we see in the version in the movie, which is her getting ready to, you know, basically like go on her last ride. And I think the buildup in this scene is actually really great. And I wish there was more of it because it gives something to Bobby that he doesn't have in the final film, which is an actual moment with Laura that feels like earned.
Bad news, kid. It was baby laxative.
What was?
Stuff from last night.
Baby laxative? We can't snort baby laxative.
Oh, shit. I killed a guy for baby laxative.
Coming to when you kill a guy for baby laxative.
Don't get funny on me again.
I'm not.
How much of the you just want the drugs, you don't care about me is in the final one versus this?
I think it's kind of mostly just that.
It's mostly just that.
Yeah,
okay.
It's that and just sort of the I'm going home stuff.
Okay, right.
And then back to the sheriff's office. Again, you can't have this scene without the other, so either they both got to go or both go in. There's this stuff with the radio and Sheriff Truman going off to... There's some prowler outside Josie's house. And then our only Lucy check-in.
Yeah, it's almost like too goofy for the movie.
It's way too goofy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the show, perfect. It's, for the movie,
yeah.
Not.
Yeah.
Well, it's even pretty goofy for the show, but yeah. Mm.
I don't know. I mean, there's some stuff with Lucy that leads me to believe that her object permanence is not state-of-the-art.
Yeah, fair.
I did like the scream at the end when her and Andy nearly collide. I thought that was pretty good.
That's pretty intense. Scream.
Yeah.
Dual scream. I think it's both of them, right?
Yeah. And this next sequence, again, is a thing I definitively wish was in the final film.
I was thinking back. I was watching it again and just scrubbing through. And I was like, oh, wait, this is not in the movie?
Yeah,
this
feels
like it
really
should
be. I had a similar reaction.
This may be more than any other scene I wish was actually in the movie because it is terrifying.
Yeah.
And through so little do they convey so much fear.
I think it's the extremely slow car is maybe the creepiest part of it to me.
It's that, and it's the way they keep cutting back between... So Leland comes home as Laura is sneaking out. She sees him, hides in the bushes, and the way he just sort of zombie-like shuffles up the walkway and periodically turns and death stares in her direction.
Right at her. Like, he clearly is staring at her, and, like, she is like, don't, just keep moving. But then, like, kind of Terminator style turns around to continue walking up the steps.
Yeah.
And then we'll stop again and just be like, oh, I know you're there.
Yeah. And they do it twice, and this is one case where I don't feel like the doing it twice thing is, like, them being superfluous or weird for weird's sake. Like, every moment, every step he takes is just harrowing, and
yeah.
It's so good that I just wish it was in there because it doesn't fuck with the pacing or do anything really that isn't that couldn't be there.
Yeah, I think yes, it just adds to the threatening nature of this character.
Yeah, and then the last bits here, there is a scene with the log lady crying as she hears the screams in the woods. I wish that was there too, because that is something we hear about in the show, and it doesn't take anything away to have that quick cut to her.
And she's in the final cut talking to Laura.
Yeah, that, like, part is in there.
Yeah, so, like, you could just follow up with her.
Yeah.
It would, yeah.
Probably don't need the long language shot of the body floating in the water that we have here, but...
No.
But then they cut back to this other part, this part we talked about earlier, in the red room. There's a longer version of it, and it does change because it's the part where Cooper is talking about how he needs to leave, and they're just like, there's no way out but home, basically.
No face, no, no. Ah, home.
And since we know what we know about Cooper and his entrapment, it kind of seems like this is the arm saying you're stuck here.
Oh, yeah.
And again, unless you were going to re-edit this movie pretty significantly, I don't think there's room for this or the Annie stuff that comes immediately afterward. But I wish there was.
Yeah. The nurse puts on the ring. That's what happens in this one.
Yeah. So, like, they wheel Annie into the hospital. She's fucked up.
Yeah.
We never really saw the aftermath of what happened to Annie in the show. She is bloody and messed up and comatose. And so they wheel her in there. They get her into a room, and there's a nurse checking on her. And she turns to the nurse and says the exact same thing, in, like, almost turning her head the exact same way that she says to Laura in her dream.
Hmm.
And then goes comatose again.
Yeah, that was another example of where it felt like they had dialogue in multiple places, like maybe just to give themselves options for which one to use, or maybe for the repetition.
Yeah.
Is it she projecting herself?
She could be. That's how I took it to be, is that is the moment when she projects herself into Laura's dream.
Oh, sure.
Then this other lady gets the ring.
Is that? I almost thought that was Julia Stiles as the nurse for a second. I don't think
she has the look. It's not her. Now I have to know how you felt about this final bit here. Cooper.
I hate to say it.
Cooper in the bathroom.
Did they reshoot this entire thing for this? I'd have to go. I mean, because it's shot in like whatever widescreen format they used here, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I'd have to go back and compare it to the actual last episode, but I wondered if did they redo this entire sequence for this.
I think they did.
Yeah, that was my assumption.
I don't like it.
You know, like
I didn't
it.
Need it. I don't hate it, but I didn't need it.
It just feels like it deflates that.
Yeah,
moment.
Yeah, it did.
Rather than escalate or do it, like it makes it normal. It normalizes that moment in a way that you're like, oh, this feels like coming back from the season break, and you're like, what is going to happen? And they're like, oh yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. It's all explained away.
But it's not though.
Well, for Harry and for the doctor, I feel like they're like, you know, they're like, oh, you gotta get you back to bed, man.
Yeah. But you see in that moment that it is clearly not Cooper that as we know him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But we knew. I feel like I knew that at the end of season two. Like, yeah. I'm not sure there's too much here that adds to it. I mean, there was a tension, right, at the end of season two where you're like, oh, my gosh, are they going to realize it's not Cooper?
It feels like you've just been left on a cliffhanger. You're being told that, like, if you're putting the scene in the movie, you're being told that, like, oh, they're going to address that cliffhanger. And then they start a new sentence and then immediately cut it off again.
Totally. Yeah, like it's a different cliffhanger, but not as good as the first one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad, like in some regards, I'm glad they came back to try and do something with this. But like I said, when I saw this originally, when they came in, I was like, oh, here we go. And then when it ended, I was like, oh, man.
Now you understand why it's not in the final film.
I don't know why they would have shot that, like with the knowledge that the return will happen. I can totally see like, oh, we need some connective tissue, or there's something else we want to expand on here.
Yeah.
Knowing that we're going to get back to this storyline at some point. Of course, you did say that this was a 3-picture deal, so maybe they did.
Yeah.
They did.
Maybe this would have been the lead in to whatever the next movie was.
Yeah. 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 So actually I forgot about that. So this could have been that, but in the context of we'll never get to make Twin Peaks again, it seems like such a weird thing to do.
It is, and it's totally understandable why you'd keep this out. You don't put this in the final film, because I think even more so than the various check-ins with the various personalities around the show, if you put this in the movie that you made and just leave that there for people to dangle, they're just going to get even angrier, because it's like it does not, like you said, it doesn't flesh out anything. It just reminds you that, oh, by the way, the show ended on this note.
This is in today's standard, this would be like a Marvel post-credit scene.
Yeah.
Like you'd say, stick around. Oh my gosh, you see who they pulled Coop out of the rubble. It's his fist.
Not necessary.
Not necessary.
But I think worth knowing and having seen in reference to where we go from here.
Sure. Like you said, the stuff that's in this that winds up being referenced?
Referenced, yeah. Okay. Some cases very explicitly, sometimes kind of offhandedly, but it's worth having this stuff in your head. Just, you know, even if it doesn't appear in the exact form it does in these scenes, you can still point at the screen and go, I remember that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also in hindsight kind of nice they did some safety shots like this, because they weren't getting this crew back together for another 20 years, right? So they kind of couldn't without doing some de-aging makeup to go back and revisit some of these characters and scenes and
that's
all that stuff.
That's the thing I read when I was reading that book, Your Laura Disappeared. Like the author is talking about, like, it was wild seeing these scenes for the first time so many years after the fact, because it felt like the people he knew from Twin Peaks had been preserved in amber. You know, like they were there the age roughly they were in the show, and this was all new stuff that these people had never seen before, that existed from this era with these actors looking the way he remembered them looking.
Like, it's almost like you could almost do a thing with some of these deleted scenes, the ones that we just said really don't belong in this movie at all, like the Norma stuff and the Cooper stuff, working it into the return as like people almost as flashbacks and being like, what the fuck, how'd they get that footage?
Yeah.
You know, and being like, oh, how did they plan ahead so many years ago to do this thing?
Yeah. There's always a plan and there's never a plan. That's the David Lynch way.
I guess so. Do it on set.
Yeah. Fuck it. We'll do it live. And that is the missing pieces, folks. As we said, this is much more supplemental material, and it will come only up in reference and other things as we are talking about Twin Peaks The Return in a couple of weeks here. But yeah, that's it. You know, I just wanted you guys to see this and to just kind of gauge how you felt about all of it.
Look, the table is now set for the return.
The Formica table is set.
The Formica table, oh, it's a nice Formica, is now set. But all that's left is to watch and absorb The Return.
Yes. The greatest 18-hour movie you've ever seen. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how many 18-hour movies you've seen, but...
Yeah. You kind of talked a little bit about this at the beginning of the last episode we did. Mm-hmm. Firework and the movie. How was this received?
This is a thing that was built for fans of Twin Peaks and giving them a taste of a thing they couldn't have when the movie came out. And so I think generally people were very happy to see this at all, especially considering when this came out, The Return had not been announced. They had not said definitively they were doing it yet.
Gotcha. Okay. And people had been aching for more. They'll take anything at that point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And this was bonus material, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
This didn't have to stand on its own because it was coming with a larger set.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it does factor in its own way. And you will find out the ways in which it factors in or doesn't in about 2 weeks. As we said, there's a one-week break on the Watchcast, and then second week of May, we are launching in to Twin Peaks, The Return. And I'm very excited about doing that, and it seems like you guys are as well.
I just need to know. I need to either be disappointed or satisfied.
One hope and or dream you have for The Return, and I will eventually crush it for you.
You're asking.
What is the thing
rhetorical?
You want to see in The Return that you're hopeful of?
I don't know if I can answer. I've intentionally been blanking my mind going into it because I don't think I want expectations. Like,
yeah.
Like Lynch is so weird. Like Twin Peaks is so weird. And offbeat and unexpected. Like, I kind of just want to approach it as pure, like, you know, like you remember me saying, like, I don't even want to know who's in it.
Yeah.
I want the nature of Bob and what is going on in the lodge to be either explicitly talked about, like have Cooper do a thing or at least posit a theory about how it fits into the larger world. My fear, that's what I would like. I would like that the nature of how Bob works and what the spirits are, and is he a demon? Like, what's going on with these worlds? I also would really like to know more about Briggs's role and what they're doing in the government. My fear is they leave it so open-ended and leave it with more mysteries dangling at the end that I will be like, should we expect some more Twin Peaks to come to address this? Or is it, you can leave mysteries that are satisfying at the end and be like, go home, go interpret, but not like I don't want another Coop bashing his head into the mirror ending. That's my fear.
Here's what I will say.
Okay.
You could end The Return with no more Twin Peaks, and I think I would be able to walk away from that saying, I'm good.
Would you have felt that way at the end of season two?
No.
Okay. Okay.
I think that there is stuff that is left dangling, but more of it will be at least articulated, if not actually explained, than not.
I think like even David Lynch is rational enough to know how lucky he was to get another crack at this, right?
Yeah, and to do it his way.
Yeah. I don't mind interpreting some stuff myself, but I'd like to see what he thinks is going on.
All right.
A little more explicitly. So yeah, I'm excited.
I will tell you nothing about who is in it, what is happening, or anything going in. All I will say, it is a star-studded affair, it is a musically diverse affair, and it has at least a couple of the wildest episodes of television I have ever seen.
Cool.
And I will leave it at that. So in 2 weeks, look for that. Twin Peaks The Return, kicking off with the first two episodes, and we'll be doing two episodes an episode for the whole duration. Some of those are going to go long by virtue of some of those very wild episodes I mentioned. But I think that will probably be our structure going into about July is probably when we're going to end up wrapping this. So get hype, folks. It's here. The thing you've been waiting for. You didn't even have to wait 25 years for it.
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is going to do it for this here bonus episode. As always, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who has been listening and watching along at home with us. We'll see you in a couple of weeks for Twin Peaks The Return.